Welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast, where we explore the kind of thinking we need to navigate a positive way forward. I'm your host, Maura Gamble, permaculture educator and global ambassador, filmmaker, eco-villager, food forester, mother, practivist, and all-round lover of thinking, communicating, and acting regeneratively. For a long time, it's been clear to me that to shift trajectory to a thriving one planet way of life, we first need to shift our thinking. The way we perceive ourselves in relation to nature, self, and community is the core. What better way to make sense than to join together with others in open, generative conversation? In this podcast, I'll share conversations with my friends and colleagues, people who inspire and challenge me in their ways of thinking, connecting, and acting. These wonderful people are thinkers, doers, activists, scholars, writers, leaders, farmers, educators, people whose work informs permaculture and spark the imagination of what a post-COVID, climate-resilient, socially just future could look like. Their ideas and projects help us to make sense in this changing world, to compost and digest the ideas, and to nurture the fertile ground for new ideas, connections, and actions. It's my absolute delight to welcome to the show today David Holmgren. David is the co-originator of permaculture with Bill Mollison. He was the co-author way, way, way back in 1978 of Permaculture One, the very first book about permaculture, and has since published many books about permaculture, from The Flywire House, A Case Study in Design Against Bushfire, to these 2002 book, which has been translated into many languages and been spread around the world, Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability. He's written case studies about the property that he and his partner Sue have designed and developed in central Victoria, Meliodora. And in 2018, he published Retrosuburbia, The Downshifter's Guide to a Resilient Future. Earlier this year, I visited David in his property to talk about how permaculture can help us respond to the massive bushfires that Australia had experienced over the summer, and we had no idea what was about to come. You'll find the link to that interview down below. But I wanted to talk to David again to really think about where we are now and how permaculture can help us as a tool to make sense of this changing world and to help us collectively move forward. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I always have a fantastic time when I get together and chat with David. And please feel free to share this conversation and, in fact, all the episodes of Sense Making in a Changing World. So thank you so much, David, for joining us on the show today. It's been a few months since we spoke. I came and filmed at your place back in February, and we were talking particularly about permaculture and how it related to the extreme bushfire catastrophe that Australia had just come through. And we had no idea what was about to hit us. And since that time, you know, the world has gone into lockdown with COVID. So on the back of all of this, we, you know, COVID lockdown, the bushfires, drought, and then, you know, the climate emergency that we're in, all of these things together, I keep coming back to permaculture as being such a practical way that we can respond to this. And I'm just wondering whether we might be able to explore that a little bit about how you see permaculture really helping families, particularly families now that we are around the world, become far more home-based and garden-based, more than we'd ever possibly imagine, that somehow your work, I think, with Retrosuburbia in particular, has just become absolutely so much more relevant and visible, I think, to where people are at right now. And where do you think we need to be heading, or how do you think permaculture can help us navigate these really challenging times?
Yeah, well, I suppose I've, over the years, had various points of urgency about some sort of communication work in relation to permaculture. And I suppose when I started coming back into the permaculture movement through teaching permaculture design courses a decade after Bill Mollison started those in the early 80s, and I started teaching in early 90s. And then as we approached the millennium when released my book, Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, And then again in 2018 with publishing Retro Suburbia, that sense of the world changing and needing to get ideas not just out, but people being influenced by those and making positive changes built on the ones they were already doing, whether that was from permaculture influenced or in other ways. I had a real sense over the last few years of crises that would fold in on people, and I knew enough about through my future scenarios work that it's very hard to say what those will be, but the underlying systemic conditions of a civilization which is built on an unsustainable premise were going in some way or other bring those crises back home to people in affluent countries, in our suburbs and cities. And to me, the looming one was the insanely large Australian property bubble seemed the more likely immediate proximate effect than either geopolitical upheaval or climate disasters. We knew climate disasters were increasing, but inevitably even something as catastrophic and extensive as the bushfires that for so many people on the East Coast felt like the whole world was burning is still in a sense a localised disaster. Whereas the pandemic has been sort of everywhere. And so like finance and like some of those larger structural things, and because of its immediacy and the sort of existential threat, it's remarkable how people's behaviour has changed, but also how governments have changed from a position of, oh, we're the government. Oh, markets don't fix these things. Oh, we have to do something. So many illusions that have been predominant over the last three or four decades, and one of those that the market provides all answers, have been smashed. And I think at a more domestic level, the idea that life and all the good things in life are sort of somehow we get through the monetary economy, and that then totally supports, combined with debt, some little sort of shriveled up version of home compared with how our forebears lived, where home was a rich and diverse place, not rich in a material sense, but so many people living together, doing things in the household and the community non-monetary economy. So as people have been thrown back through isolation, through job loss, through various aspects of the pandemic in their home space, some have found it very dismal, very like a prison, very lacking, and others have found, oh, here is the opportunities to do so many things that they'd maybe thought about but had never had the time or had never seen the priority. And, of course, the dramatic one that we're all aware of is how so many people have become food producers or scaled up what they're already doing in that domain. So permaculture, I suppose, as an agent of positive influence over four decades in Australia, is sort of in the background of so many people's sort of concept of possibilities. And I think that's been an incredible positive influence on people making changes at home to make themselves more resilient to uncertainty and shocks and challenges, but also just the boot in the bum, like perhaps a drug addict needs from some sort of crisis to go, oh, we need to change. So I think that's been big positive change that's come through what is inevitably a sort of difficult time.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it feels like like you're saying, that sort of the kick to make it happen. Like, people know about it, and I think, like you're saying, that there's a sense about what permaculture is, and that there's another way that we could actually be moving forward. But actually getting the shift from the consumer way of life, or from, you know, the debt or the type of that way, to this, to what you describe in Retrosuburbia and what's described in you know, most of the permaculture work, how do you make that leap? And I think that's, it's taken this crisis to create that leap at this point. But from now, so the door's been opened, or the lid's been lifted, and there's this new awareness. How do we continue to encourage people to either move towards this in an ongoing way, or to actually take this opportunity now and to continue, rather than just to have this idea that we can snap back to normal? Like, there is no normal anymore. There's not going to be a going back. That normal has changed. But how can we make sure that we weave in the permaculture way, I suppose, more visibly, and give people more of an opportunity to actually find their way into this? Like, have you got any ideas on that?
Yeah, well, I think it's at two broad levels. The change in the collective mindset of what is the story and what is the options mean there's a possibility of extending the ideas to a much wider audience. You know, it's that classic thing of the in-group of people who are into something, even in some sort of subcultural sense, and some notion of mainstream. So those opportunities start to open up more easily. But perhaps even more important than that is the role of consolidating where there already is interest. So, for example, with food growing, so many people can see that home food growing is a good thing to do. But the process of doing it is very site and situation specific, and involves skill and persistence, and involves dependence on the cycle of the seasons, which you can't fast track, you know, by throwing more resources at it. So I think, as Kat Labors has pointed out, so many Australians have tried home food production, and many more keep trying it. But also there's people who drop out of doing that, and some of that is, well, it's just some sort of life change situation and it doesn't suit their particular situation. But a lot of it is, because it's turned out to be a bit more technically complicated than I thought, or I didn't get the results I'd hoped for, or, you know, that I first got. So getting that resources to keep skilling people up, and I think that's everything from the chat over the fence with the neighbour, and, you know, exchanging seeds and that sort of thing, right through to structured online courses and those sorts of things. So, for example, I've just given a promotional blurb to some local colleagues here who run a better fruit growing course, and a professional organic orchardists who've now in retirement, you know, have this amazing, you know, online courses that people can really get down to nitty gritty on getting more skill, and whether that's, you know, how to prune your apple trees, or you know, dealing with brown rot in apricots, and, you know, those nitty gritty things that take, okay, here's a good idea, yeah, we can see how it works generally, how do we get better at that? So I think there's, and of course it's not just in food growing, it's all aspects, right through to sort of controversial issues like, okay, for example, wood burning technology. Is wood an appropriate, sustainable energy source, and you know, how much can that be functional in suburbs and cities, and people's experience with things like a rocket stove, a cool technology that a lot of people know about, but actually exactly how does it work? You know, what does, did that model really work well? Is that, does that achieve the, you know, the zero smoke output that, you know, these technologies can achieve? So you're not annoying the neighbours and you are actually doing something to reuse local renewable biomass and be more, you know, self-reliant. So those sort of learning the skills, learning what's relevant and extending those examples in different ways, I think is a big part of the way forward.
Taking it from being, you know, something that we've supported or have a nice idea about, or but and really diving into it in a very practical way. And I also think, you know, coming back onto what you were saying with Kat's information, that she's done the research on about, you know, as many more people are doing it as they're kind of falling off the other end. But it's not to say that those people who have done it and stopped doing it aren't completely changed by that experience. There's something that's happened by their experience of having a go at it that has either more connected them with their community, with their seeds, their source of food, their thinking about food in itself, their thinking of community, of the whole system, and maybe connected them in with, you know, more localized food system. And so I think even if it's a short-term exposure to it, that itself is an important thing.
Yeah, well, that's certainly, some of those influences are ones that I wrote about in an essay in 1991 called Gardening as Agriculture, and talking about how even the experience of being a home food producer and not that not becoming sort of a regular thing someone does, that experience often makes them a more appreciative customer of local in-season produce and tolerant to the cosmetic ups and downs of whether something is perfect, rather than the spoiled brat consumer that our centralised food system is made of most people, which is very difficult for any organic sustainable agriculture to supply without there being, you know, enormous exploitation of people and nature to do so. So learning to go with the flow of the seasons and the incredible abundance and the sort of things that happen in a community supported agriculture where, you know, you get the abundance when it's there and not so much, you know, when it's not. That appreciation comes from having grown some of your own food.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think the other huge one, of course, is when people do that at home with children, and those children only really need to be just around that they are osmotically absorbing that, especially, of course, as very young children and even babies, more than cranky chip on the shoulder teenagers. But people who experience that early and may sort of reject that or think that's not interesting, of course, later in life, that seed is there. And in the right circumstances, we've seen a lot of examples where that comes back immediately. So just exposing children to those diverse aspects of self-reliance, do-it-yourself, doing things in that household and community economy that's not everything based on money. I think sort of puts that idea in children's heads. Oh, yeah, there's other ways to provide for our needs other than earning money and then that being the source of everything.
I was just going to say that, with the retro-suburbia concepts you're talking about, which is in a way similar to, you know, our rural version of that here in the eco-village, where it's not just about what you're doing in your own household too, it's what you're doing in between the households in an area, that neighbourhood, that relationship, your community economy, your community food growing. It's a kind of a level that embraces your household and creates a context for your household to be able to do all those things and to see how you can have those relationships of trading and exchanging and helping and supporting, and that actually you can do so much without having to use money at all. I mean, I forget to take my purse when I go to town because I don't need any money where I am based here. You know, it's so such an interesting way to live. And when you grow up in that, with those exchanges, those non-monetary exchanges, those, you do it because it's part of your mutual aid, and not because, not necessarily also because you have to, because you want to, because it's a much more joyful way of having an economy. And it's a real economy, but it's just not a monetary one. And I think it's, yeah. I think you're absolutely right. Growing up, feeling that joy in that is really interesting.
The value that comes with a product or a service, like the meaning that what the source is increasingly the thing which is lacking in the centralized economy. Mm-hmm. So any product or service doesn't really have any embedded value in that sense, because you've got no idea who produced it or where it came from. So whether it's a dining table that you're sitting eating at, where you know who made the table and where the wood came from, let alone a whole house, or whether it's the food you're eating, those connections, which of course can be there in the monetary economy when it's small scale, when it's local, when it's by people who are working in businesses that are actually controlled by a natural person rather than a non-natural person called a corporation. Those sorts of possibilities, of course, are there. And those monetary economies themselves grow naturally out of where people do things for themselves and their family and their community and get good at it and get better at it, and it actually becomes a livelihood. So that natural organic process of sensible monetary economies emerging out of those household and community non-monetary economies. It's interesting, yeah, what you're saying about in a rural context, a lot of people recognise the strengths of possible greater self-reliance at a rural context, and often feel that unless they can move to the country with a larger property, they can't do that. And what I've suggested in Retro Suburbia, my whole work is based on it, apart from the fact that suburbia is where most Australians live, and most Australians are not going to be able to just by choice or whatever change where they live. And our experience has been, of course, that that is quite a difficult transition in itself if you, you know, don't have that experience. I found as a consultant to people making the move to the country that if people came from families where there was a background of self-employment or small business, they often actually, even if they had no experience of rural living and farming, they made a better go of it, because moving to the country was like going into business, mm-hmm. where you had to take more decisions for yourself. Whereas people who are used to, you know, grown up in families where money comes in into the bank account, you know, there's not a connection between work and actually your sources of sustenance, that it is quite challenging, this shift to how do we do more things for ourselves. And the best place for most people to do that is in the territory that they're familiar with, the scale they're familiar with, and for most people that is suburbia. But I think suburbia also is a sweet point, because apart from the fact that at least on a a 500 plus square metre block with a modest house in most Australian climates, you can produce a very significant part of the diet of fresh food, and in houses where there's workshops and storage space, you can actually have lots of, if you like, home maintenance and manufacturing and tools, stuff that is hard to do in high-density apartment living, where you depend more definitely on collective resources, whether those are collectively owned or whether they're in the market economy. And at that suburban scale, so you have some of the elements that we associate with rural self-reliance, but you also have the collective critical mass of people close together within walking and bicycling distance to actually develop those community exchanges without it being dependent on cars and longer distance commuting to find those people. Now, of course, that also depends on where are the places where these cells of, if you like, retro suburban living start to develop. And I think it doesn't take too many people along that line in a neighbourhood or in a street to start to sort of build those possibilities. And those possibilities can then draw in other people over time. And, of course, the opportunities created by the pandemic mean that more people who might not have the ideas but just suddenly, oh, what's that person doing down the street? Those possibilities are there for creating those critical mass of people that we historically associate with the capacity of cities.
Mm.
So in that sense, suburbia is that sweet point where the advantages of the rural and the city can come together, which was actually, of course, the original vision when suburbia started. But in a lot of ways, it's become the worst of both possibilities.
I grew up in it. I grew up in a suburb. I had a brilliant childhood. You know, I grew up on the outskirts of Melbourne. It was a place called Ringwood. And from where I was, I could see all the bush, and I grew up knowing all the local birds and the local species. And we had, you know, some gardens down the back and some chooks, and I knew everyone up and down the street. There actually weren't many fences in between all of our places, and all the kids were out on the street all times, you know, and you know, gradually you'd hear people calling out, you know, to come in at a certain time. And down the bottom of the development was a creek, and you know, go down there and collect the tadpoles and you know, go on expeditions. And it was a wonderful place. My school was down the bottom end of the road. There was my parents still live there now, and they still know many of the people up and down the street. My mum still runs the book club, which has been going for, I don't know, 60 years or something. Wow. You know, there's this great sense of community, because I think it was of a scale, you know, a quarter acre blocks. There was enough space to have nature and food and community, and they had reasonable services like schools and local shops and local libraries. Mm. And, you know, there was the services embedded within it, and it had a great sense of place. It was my world for, you know, 15, 16 years until I sort of, my concept of the world expanded quite significantly. And so I absolutely agree that.
And do you think that that provided a base or a foundation for your later discovery of
permaculture? Absolutely, because I had a really deep sense of place. I understood, you know, like I understood how nature fitted into our world. I understood the deep sense of safety and connection that I felt with that community, and that, you know, I knew everyone up and down the street, and I felt safe walking up and down the street. And I knew who, you know, who was the builder, who was the person who did, you know, like there's the lady down the road was a seamstress. So for my 14th birthday, my mum gave me a sewing machine and sewing lesson. So I went and learned how to sew with her. And you know, there was all these interconnections that were happening up and down the street. You know, my dad still goes and borrows tools from the guy across the road who's the builder. And there's this, the relationships form in that way. What's not there, though, is any sense of work in terms of monetary work. There's a lot of non-monetary work and a community connection. But I'm wondering, like, where do we start to layer this? You know, I could hear you talking about that in what you were saying before, and I'm thinking maybe it's something that we need to really start thinking a lot more, particularly as our economic system is in decline. It's changing rapidly. There's a lot of unemployment now. How within the retro suburbia system can we be looking at those types of communities or any type of you know, suburb and start to think differently about how we work and generate income within that as well? Because while we can diminish our need for gas, we still obviously need. And and so where does that fit? And also particularly from thinking about the young people, you know, thinking about hope and future and positivity and ways of moving forward and actually, like you're saying, building your economy out of this gift economy that exists there. And I think, I mean, that's how my livelihood has emerged. I followed my passion and then eventually, you know, it became the thing that I just do all this. I've never had a real job. My job has always been teaching permaculture and doing permaculture, designing permaculture, and it's my livelihood that's emerged out of my love of doing that. And how can we layer that kind of thing on into retro suburbia or even just be really practical, I suppose?
So, I mean, just going back to the brilliant example that you gave of your own experience growing up, I tried to capture that, of course, in my Aussie Street story, which, you know, charts a typical Australian street from the 1950s through to the Second Great Depression of the 2020s to show that sort of how we can actually create the best of what existed in the past with the new opportunities that exist today. And in spite of the huge challenges that range from, you know, unaffordable housing to, you know, looming climate catastrophe, that there are unique opportunities historically about the current situation that allows us to do so much more than was done in those suburbs that you and I grew up in. And I think the first one is the way the miniaturisation and of technology and the networking. And the obvious one, of course, is information technology and the incredible potential of home-based work, which didn't exist when we were young. And so you and I and many others have learnt how to be able to engage in the world from home. And it's amazed me how long it's taken for society to go, oh, you know, like a whole lot of things are actually possible. Oh, maybe we don't actually need to commute. Oh, maybe as a company we don't need all that office space in the city. You know, maybe all that traffic isn't actually as big a problem as we thought it would be, or even the need for massively expensive city metro networks to allow everyone to commute. So making full use of what is that obvious potential, I think, is a huge and obvious part of it. I mean, there's downsides and risks in all of that too, of the online digital world. But even when we go back and look at more traditional jobs like manufacturing, you know, and I look at my own role as an ecological builder and woodworker, and I think of what was required in a joinery workshop to make sophisticated things like a door or windows, you know, 50 years ago, and these huge lathes and milling machines and, you know, very complex, big, expensive, heavy cast iron equipment, that so much of that is available at a very small scale technology. And a lot of people actually even have this stuff sitting in their workshop that in any third world country, people would just with those few tools be making a livelihood out of their garage. Yes. Now, of course, in an affluent economy like Australia, you know, there's a lot more challenges and difficulties. And one of the impediments has been also the planning regulations that have said, this is a residential area, you can't do you know, business activity. But we've got the miniaturisation of actually manufacturing technology. We've got the complete availability of information technology. And then the third element is we've got relative to the past, we've got huge houses, huge garages, huge spaces with actually very few people living in them and spending very little time in them. That means there's a huge capacity, unused capacity, if we look at it from a business point of view, in the family home. And, of course, we've had a tax regime that allows people to do that and build great extensions and never be there, even if they're away working, paying the debt to sort of pay for it all. It doesn't need to be used and occupied, because that idea that, well, that's just home. Whereas it, whether that's because those privileges of the protection of the family home against government tax and whatever decline, or whether it's people just taking the opportunities, I think there's huge opportunities for building monetary economies through local livelihoods where people live, and that they are completely new opportunities that didn't exist before. So the terrace house that Sue and I used to rent in Carlton before we moved to Hepburn Springs, I believe in the Depression, you know, there was 16 people living in that terrace house. Well, you know, we were relatively densely populated in the 80s there with three adults and two children. A lot of the terrace houses in that street had one or two people in them. Now, if you said to the people in the Depression, well, you need to put twice as many people in the house to get better efficiencies out of the household economy, sorry, it's already full and overcrowded. But in our modern current situation, there's huge opportunities for more people to be living together or working, coming to work at a place part-time without necessarily that commuting long distances. And of course, that's how some of us have been living in permaculture. We've been modelling this, but now I think there's the possibility of a lot more people living this way.
I think so too. And I'm really interested, as well as the retro-suburban model of rethinking the existing suburbs. And I had friends who lived in Carlton in some of those streets. And what I thought was, just before I go on to my next question, was it was fantastic because they actually blocked off some of the streets, and those really broad avenues of grass became parks that, you know, people would be having picnics in the street. And I would imagine, I imagined back then too, like, what if they actually just took away the roads there in, you know, in that grid system, and half of them just became parks and food forest? Automatically you would be transforming that, and it wouldn't really affect much of the traffic system there anyway, because they're all little localized streets. It would be a brilliant way to make a shift on. And anyway,
the space is in our residential communities. Once you start to see the public space in a way other than this is all allocated to cars, and that it's all outsourced to, oh well, the council manages that, to again community engagement. Of course, although retro suburbia focuses primarily on we have control over the property, it spills over, of course, into beyond the boundaries of management of public land, and that redeveloping that informal community governance of the commons that, of course, existed for our ancestors, but to an extent even existed in the suburbs, and certainly in small towns like where we live here in Hepburn Springs. All of the public land historically was just managed by the community with sheep and, you know, other grazing animals and whatever. And of course, we've been in the last 20 or 30 years redeveloping permaculture versions of that informal management of the community land. And I think those sort of models from the more feral fringes of small rural towns where councils don't have the money anyway to manage all this land, it's a problem for them, that those models can progressively move back into the more formally managed neat and tidy suburbs as councils run out of money to do that management, and people don't want the herbicide or even, you know, the noisy mowers, that another set of possibilities start to emerge.
I think there's a really important. Big possibility there with the commons. And I'm also thinking too, my next part of the question was about taking that, it's not so much retrofitting, but thinking about, well, there's still so many new suburbs that are being developed. Like, where are the permaculture people on the table of those? And there were some really fantastic suburbs that I visited in places like Denmark, where they have the farm. And I also hear that there's agri-suburbia, what are they called, agriburbia models, like in the United States, where they look at the whole land and they go, okay, so we put the farm here. This is the best agricultural land. We'll have the farm, and then the houses are, you know, pushed into smaller plots around that. And so the commons is a farm, an organic farm, and they actually employ a farmer. And then all the wastewater and nutrients come from those houses into the farm. And then you can either work at this farm to get, you know, on your weekend and get a discount box, or you can just pay a little bit extra and get your box. But there's this sense that the commons in your landscape is around about actually collecting the nutrients and the waste and producing your food and being, you know, you've got shared bees, shared cows, shared goats, shared chickens. And so it doesn't have to be either a rural thing or, you know, an eco-village thing. It could actually be a suburb that is designed from scratch with these principles in place. But, you know, have you seen the invitation of permaculture people to be on these types of
It's funny you should say that.
Or how can we get them to be on the table? Maybe my other question.
Having been a developer of a rural eco-village, the Friars Forest village on a smaller scale than where you live, and having been involved at that scale and then my work more focusing on retrofitting the suburbs, and that a view that the crises were coming on us so fast that largely we would be living with the building stock that we've already got. And I've been on the record as saying, actually, we've probably got enough buildings in this country if we really used them, and especially when all the dog shampoo services and excess cafes and gymnasia businesses go broke and there's more buildings to retrofit, and when people are working from home, all those offices. So that, in a sense, I've been a strong advocate for a decade or more that we're moving into a world of retrofitting what we've already got rather than new build. But it's interesting you say that, because, of course, yes, suburbs are still being built and will continue as long as the real estate bubble doesn't deflate. And, of course, governments will, if it's the last thing they'll do, they are trying to sort of keep that going, because that is actually the driver more than, oh, more housing is actually needed. But at my own community in Daylesford and Hepburn, there's very little land available for expansion, but there is strong demand, you know, for people wanting to come and live in a nice small town. And we have some of the best horticultural land in the district, which is sort of in town, that was zoned residential because it's relatively, you know, accessible and close to the services decades ago, which is finally being developed. And there's one proposal now for 50 houses and other land. And I've been seeing this happening. Of course, there's tensions in the community over this. And I've been approached by both the people who are opposing this development, taking it to the appeals tribunal, and by the developer wanting to get a permaculture framework into this development. You know, and that it was already has in the heart of it a co-housing model, which will be bought and developed by an older women's residential co-op. So there's, yeah, these amazing possibilities there. And it's that's an example of sort of being on that, if you like, ethical boundary of how much are you prepared to sort of try and put effort in to make existing development a bit better, and how much do you radically sort of reject and resist these inappropriate developments and actually hope for the day when property values are going down and all of this development will come to an end rather than being constrained by, you know, by environmental regulations. So how can we sort of manage those things? And I think there are openings because people are now seeing that maybe the potential customers don't necessarily want to move into a place with black roofed houses, you know, with no eaves to the boundaries of the block and some sterile bit of public land that the council manages and, you know, no space to grow food, that they actually want something different to that. And that breaking that spell that's been created, and this has been well documented by academics, that a combination of the real estate industry, the banks and the big builders have created that template of suburbs, of modern suburbs, as though this is what people want. They don't. This is what they've been told will be the best investment for your money. Even if it's a shit place to live, you will be out paying the mortgage on it, and hopefully in your dreams you will move to somewhere nicer. You know,
interesting, so, though, when you look
so
at the
market, think that possibility, I think of doing something different, there's a lot of interest in that.
Yeah, because when you see the marketing of it, you know, the big billboards or anything, they show people walking through natural area along bike paths with the kids on bikes or at the little local farmers market, but they don't actually show the what the development looks like. So the values that are being expressed are what we're talking about, but the reality of what's delivered is something quite other. So I think it's not such a shift to be able to bring in, you know, permaculture design, a really holistic approach to landscape design, architecture, urban design and development into a new frame that, you know, I think if there's a few really substantial examples that show a different way, it could flip. And it's not to say that either that I support the expansion of you know, the major cities out, but they are happening. And instead of actually them being now still creating these dreadful places that people can't really live in for, you know, they just dwell, that if there was another way forward that could spark the imagination and that could then maybe ripple on it and create a different, you know, I don't think we can't see that there's other alternatives unless we see examples of something that's working and real. So part of what I can see where we needed to go at the moment is in this storytelling. And this is what you do a lot with your Aussie Street, I know. And so it's helping to create a new narrative about what it is to live in a suburb or a city, and not to just reject it outright and say, oh no, if you're going to live a sustainable life, you have to go out to the country. That's absolute rubbish. We know that there are, wherever we are, we can be making significant changes and embedding more deeply into our community and place. And so helping to tell new stories, and that's kind of where you're going to in your publishing world at the moment too, isn't it, with the storytelling?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that Aussie Street, which is, of course, a fictional chapter in Retro Suburbia itself, but started out as a presentation that I've been doing now for many, many years of this. It's really a sort of a permaculture soap opera of, you know, what happens in the street, the good and the bad, and really telling that story in a positive, empowering way. I found it was the most powerful presentation I've ever done of all the different lectures and presentations I've done, and it allowed me to deal with very challenging, difficult threatening futures through humour and storytelling, where people can look at the story and get something from it, rather than, you know, closing off, oh, that's like completely frightening or not what relates to my own experience. So dealing with the issues of legality and neighbourhood conflict and what are the processes by which we move to self-governance, and being able to tell and explore those stories has really, for me, brought out that very important part that has been part of this general societal rediscovery of storytelling. And, of course, in our publishing business, which has gone from just publishing, self-publishing of my own books to progressively, I think the first one we did was the Permaculture Pioneers book, which you had a chapter in stories of Australian permaculture activists and how that shaped their lives. That was the first book which wasn't just my own writings. And we've done several books now by other people and colleagues. And we got sent this manuscript by permaculture teacher and writer Linda Woodrow, whose book, of course, influenced many people, the Permaculture Home Garden book, and her novel, and it's in the cli-fi genre of a near future climate change disaster set in northern New South Wales in the region where she lives, and a fantastic ripping yarn. And all of us involved in Meliodora Publishing, when we read it, we said, we've got to publish that book. You know, it was so fantastic. And, yeah, this way of exploring not just how climate change realities actually express themselves and the sort of way they unfold, you know, very like with the bushfires that have just happened, but the personal stories and the way people adapt and are brought down or come into their own power, you know, and the characters in the story, and also an amazing connection through family lineage, which is actually back to Melbourne, from this connection between northern New South Wales and Melbourne, and really charting the ideas of the counterculture, the back to the land movement, and implicitly permaculture, how they're influences over three generations, all set in only 10 years into the future. That book, I think, is also been not just like any good author of fiction researches so that there is the background facts provide a sort of real substance to the story. Linda has, of course, drawn on her own extensive experience to sort of give that concrete reality of the nitty-gritty of what those people are actually doing, how they grow food, how something gets fixed, how they work in community governance. So although permaculture is sort of barely mentioned in the book, it's all through the whole book. And so I think those stories are, yeah, very important as part of how do we see models for facing challenging futures and seeing the positives and how to navigate those challenges.
Yeah, oh gosh, and I hope there's many more stories like that. I can't wait to read it. When is it coming out? Is that coming out soon or?
Very soon. It's going to be hot off the press in a week or so.
Oh gosh,
fantastic. Having a digital launch with Linda, and then I think she'll probably be doing a small local launch in the Northern Rivers region as well. But one of the things I know she is wanting to do with the website will be to actually put her own research and evidence, not just about the climate science, which he knows a lot about that side of things, but all of the practical technologies and things that people actually do in this story. Because, yeah, that's part of, okay, you know, are those things that, you know, some readers might be interested in further exploring.
And, I think it's such a powerful way to share through story and also through film. I think there was a film that you were talking about to me early before we started recording that's come out as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've been involved in quite a few documentaries related to permaculture in recent years, but this one by two Belgian filmmakers who had a connection out to Australia, really starting with the climate activism youth, the kids on the street in Brussels, and that, do we have a future? What is happening to the world? All of that story, and then that being connected both locally to permaculture farms and environmental education and other projects that are happening in those areas where those students live, but then the filmmakers coming out to Australia and interviewing myself and another local, Patrick Jones, and right through to luminary influencers on permaculture, Alan Yeomans, the son of P.A. Yeomans, talking about climate, the crisis, and the positive futures. And it literally involved questions from some of these students directly to us, and very quirky and amazing, brilliant documentary, but making those connections between across the planet and across the generations. So I was sort of quite skeptical whether this sort of rural Australian sort of themes of solutions would, you know, connect to, you know, young urban school kids in Brussels, of the way the filmmakers decided to put this together. But I think it comes together incredibly well.
What was the title of the film?
We Have Time.
We Have Time. Yeah, that's a really good title, actually, because, you know, we're constantly having this sense that we're out of time. You know, we're run out of time. It's like, we have time. It's kind of really positive and hopeful thing. And I love the way that it's connecting, like you're saying, across the planet, but also across the generations. And I'm definitely going to link our emerging global perma-youth network in with this and use it as one of the things that they've just finished working their way through all the principles, and they're writing songs and poetry and doing artwork, and they're starting up a YouTube channel. And I think it's really important for them to also see lots of other work. So it's an exciting group to be involved in, because it is that, it's kind of that edge. It's, you know, they've come through, you know, they're not young kids anymore, but they're not, you know, they're not adults either. It's on that edge, and they're kind of asking lots of big questions about what's going on in this world. Why has it got to this point? What is the future for us? What does it hold? You know, we just see so many things collapsing around us, and, you know, where's the place for us? Where, you know, when we were growing up, there were so many different possibilities. I mean, we were facing lots of crises then too. I mean, I think that's what drove me to be involved, you know, with this. It was the, you know, it was the Franklin Dam, there was the Chernobyl crisis, there were so many different crises which led me to take the permaculture route of finding a positive way forward and address all of those, but through creating a different way. So to really bring to the fore, I think, permaculture now in a way that speaks to the teenagers, I think is such an important role that we can play to kind of unlock the potential for them, but also to share this vast knowledge that's in you, that's in all these different people around the world who've been living it for decades and who are thinking it through and have experimented with different technologies and ways and ideas, and that's not getting passed down through the school system. It's not getting passed down in any way except if they have conversations. So I'm really interested in how we can not just have it as a fringe thing or a couple of people learning. How can we actually share that a lot more so that young people have a sense that, you know, they can deepen their eco-literacy, deepen their design thinking skills, deepen, you know, their understanding of this way, and not just wait until they get to be disgruntled, you know, gone through university, started working, thought, hang on a tick, there's something else. This is not the way forward.
I think another example of that use of the creative arts in extending permaculture to young people, of course, has been the incredible work of Charlie McGee and Formidable Vegetable. I believe today they are actually at Glastonbury after they said they weren't flying anymore and not going to Glastonbury Festival, but they're there digitally, virtually, since Glastonbury Festival's not happening. That extension of permaculture thinking, of the sort of complex systemic thinking behind permaculture in the design principles and ethics, that music has been incredible at getting that understanding out there in different forms, like we said with storytelling. In fact, I've said that Charlie McGee's music is perhaps sits alongside the permaculture design course itself as like an enormous mechanism which has extended these ideas, and his new partnership with permaculture illustrator Brenna Quinlan. And the work that they're doing, taking a lot of this stuff actually back down the years from the, you know, teenagers and young adults to young children in school programs, and a lot of their recent music, which is sort of written for primary school age kids, but still the same fantastic music and ways that help kids who are also part of families pushing the boundaries into this new territory, owning that subculture in the same way that ethnic and Indigenous communities are learning to own their own culture and say, no, this is actually a positive thing that I am growing up with, rather than that industrial modernity which always seeks to diminish and demonize and make irrelevant whatever local knowledge from family, from context. And of course it's the way of the colonization of people. So reversing that process, for example, Charlie's song My Dad's Dunny about a compost toilet is really appealing to kids who might have actually been a place, you know, have grown up in a place where there's a compost toilet and feeling very embarrassed or phobic about bringing their friends home, or that thing of reversing that, of showing how positive these things are. So those types of artistic endeavours, I think, are incredibly important. And the results in schools with teachers looking for what's the next level of better stuff in environmental education that we can be doing have been lapping it up.
Yeah.
Even though they said sometimes the kids after a Charlie McGee visit, the kids are so full on, you know, and everything that they get worried.
They get too excited and uplifted. I know. It's fantastic. I guess we've been talking for a really long time, and I'd love to keep on talking, but I know you've probably got things to get on and do in your day. But before we close, I know that you do have, you've released, is it all of your book or a part of your Retro Suburbia book online? Do you want to tell us a bit about that, how people can access that?
The whole book, because the book is, I think I can see it behind you there. Yeah, it's, it's 2 kilos.
Yeah.
It's, 600 pages.
Yeah.
It's sort of a life manual, and you don't want to fall asleep reading it in bed because you might get a bruised nose. And it's $85, which a lot of people said is the best $85 they've ever spent. Mm. But we've released the book in an online format on a pay-what-you-feel basis. That means it's actually accessible to people who don't have money. And it's, we've had people pay a few dollars for it, and we've had people who said they want to support this and have paid the full price of the book, or even in some cases even more. Yes. So that this was a complete experiment we did, and what's happened is at the same time, sales of books through the pandemic have massively increased. Yeah. So it's actually worked, but it's also been a whole much more than just a digital book or an ebook, because it's actually a platform for a whole community information. And we've got a lot of people working very hard to sort of like answering all questions that come. So it's really becoming a platform for retro suburbia education.
Yeah, and you have study circle materials, study group materials as well, don't you?
There's a lot of resources on the retro suburbia website for book clubs and study circles, and progressively we're sort of adding more information to there that complement what's in the book.
So this could be a really great way for people who wanting to start a retro suburbia movement in their local community to get the book. I know there's people who've even got sets of books.
Yeah.
And distribute them in their community and started like a retro suburbia book club, and then, you know, that everyone's kind of on the same page. They look at things together and then start to implement things locally.
Yeah. Contextually. It's really three books in one, the building physical technology stuff, the biological, the gardening and backyard animals and all of that, and then the biggest field, really, the behavioural, all the way we live and organise. So it is covers a great spectrum, and people have found that book clubs and discussion groups where they look at a chapter and then come and discuss how is that relevant to us. And certainly our distribution partnership through Permaculture Principles, run by Richard Telford and our son Oliver Holmgren, that actually also allows through their management of the Meliodora Publishing wholesale that anyone can get the bookshop discounts and buy the books in quantity for those sort of discussion groups, and a lot of people have done that and are quite surprised the discounts they can get, you know, by just getting together and buying books. And in the same way that we've encouraged a lot of permaculture teachers and people running courses to that sort of collective purchase and building those sorts of things into course formats. So,
and I know that you were teaching retro suburbia trainers as well pre-COVID. Yeah. Is that something that you continue doing, or maybe going online doing possibly?
Yeah, well, we're just looking at whether that will go online or maybe continue after COVID. That's mainly been done by Beck Lowe, the editor of the book, and, of course, she's one of the most experienced permaculture teachers in the country, and we've worked together very closely apart from the book, and she probably more than anyone else knows the material inside out and has and a great experience in developing permaculture curricula material for this trainers who might want to do that and run retro suburbia workshops formally, right through to people who just want to have a kitchen table discussion with neighbors and stuff. So
So people should get in touch with you. Maybe I can put some links down below of how they can get in touch with you if they'd like to start up a book club, do some retro suburbia facilitator training, all that kind of thing. We can put all those links below, and also to the novel, which is called 470, and where they can download retro suburbia from as well. All those things, we'll put links to all of that in the show.
Interesting, Morag, the retro suburbia community Facebook page. I'm not really on social media and don't do that side of things, but Meg Ullman in the office here has sort of been managing the growth of that over the last 2 years to 5,000 active people, and then in 1 month it went to over 10,000 people on the Retro Suburbia Facebook community. So a lot of exchange and interest, and including debate happening about, you know, controversial subjects. Like I looked at one that's pretty a passion for me about wood burning, and there was, you know, 127 comments, you know, about something that had been put up about wood smoke in urban areas. So both, you know, tips and exchange of information and who's in areas, but also, you know, sensible debate about issues.
It's good to have a lively debate about, isn't it? We need to sort of unpick some of the, you know, the ideas we have about things to be able to get to the heart of it and to find our way forward differently. So, yeah, it's great. Well, thank you so much, David. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you this morning, and I'm really looking forward to continuing talking with you over the coming months as the next book comes out. Maybe we could.
I'm always supportive of the work you're doing. I think it's fantastic. You know, starting with your, you know, hands in the soil, and all of your work online is. You've been such a fantastic ambassador for permaculture all these years. So
thanks, Stephen.
Keep up the good work.
I will indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much again. And it's been a pleasure, and I'll talk to you again soon. All right. Take care.
Thank you.
So thanks for tuning in to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast today. It's been a real pleasure to have your company. I invite you to subscribe and receive notification of each new weekly episode, with more wonderful stories, ideas, inspiration, and common sense for living and working regeneratively. And call positive permaculture thinking and design into action in this changing world. I'm including a transcript below and a link also to my 4-part permaculture series, really looking at what is permaculture and how to make it your livelihood too. So join me again in the next episode, where we talk with another fascinating guest. I look forward to seeing you there.